Welcome to the space show, Bill.
Hi, Andrew. Good to see you again.
Now, there's a joke that's been around for many years that Australia's space policy is to not have a space policy. Comment?
Well, actually, that's partially true. However, there is a lot of activity in that space at the moment. Within the next 2 or 3 months, an official Australian space policy will be announced. A lot of work has been going on in that sphere for quite some time, and I can give you a little bit of the background of that if you're interested.
Yes, please.
Well, where do we start? For many years, I guess we'll start with the fact that Australia is renowned around the space community as being the only country in the world to ever have a space office and close it. So from Australia had a space office, as many of your listeners will know, had a space office from 1987 until 1996. It was closed. The Keating government did not put any money in the forward estimates for it in 1996, and when the Howard government came to office, they did nothing to reverse that and just let it die. So from 1996, there was no Australian Space Office, and essentially no Australian activity in space. There was, however, a lot of activity at the time among people who wanted to actually launch from Australia. That included Kistler, it included Cape York Space Agency, Cape York Space Agency preceded that. So at the time in 96, 97, 98, there was Kistler, there was the Asia Pacific Space Center, there was ULSI, and one other one whose name escapes me at the moment. But there were four groups that were looking to actually provide launches out of Australia, or seeing whether they could do that. So the government was in a bit of a bind, because with the space office, you had somebody who actually knew something about it to sort of monitor those things. Now they created what they called a space policy unit, and that group recognized that they had a little bit of a problem on their hands. They had a very big fish in Kistler who wanted to launch out of Australia, out of Woomera. The proponents of Kistler, Bill Kistler was the funder behind it, and it had his name, but most of the people who actually built the space shuttle were asked by Bill Kistler to come and build what they really wanted to build rather than this thing that got designed by committee. So George Miller, who was the principal architect of the shuttle, and most of his staff came over to Kistler to design a reusable rocket that could launch 20 times a year. And that was the plan. But they needed to bring it back in a recoverable form, and that was going to be at Woomera. So it was going to launch and return to Woomera. They were raising a lot of funds, and they were very serious about this project. So the government was in a situation where they needed something to set some rules of the road. And so from the period of 97 and 98, they spent a lot of time trying to put together the Space Activities Act. I was heavily involved in that in my role as the deputy chairman of what was then the Australian Space Industry of Commerce, Chamber of Commerce. It has now been renamed as the Space Industry Association of Australia. So we were very active with the government, and I must say that was one of the first times that the government actually invited industry and industry representatives to sit with them and design a policy. They understood that they didn't know that much about it, and to their credit, they came in and asked our opinions. Clearly, they made their own decisions, but they certainly involved us in the process in a lot of the efforts along the way, so much so that when the bill came to be debated in Parliament, I was actually on the phone to their advisors as the Greens were trying to put up amendments and the government was trying to decide whether they would accept those amendments or not. So we were in constant contact during the debate to decide whether they could accept or should reject these various amendments. Australia, when that was passed in December 1998, Australia became only the sixth country in the world to regulate, to have a specific law to regulate space launches from its country. And that is still in existence today. And the genesis of that was the the fact that so many people were looking at Australia as a possible launch site. Now that's in place. But to administer that, they needed a new office called the Space Licensing and Safety Office. So that, as a requirement of this bill, which is now an act, becomes, they needed somebody to staff that. So they staffed that office up. But very little, as everyone would know, none of those launches, none of those launch proponents actually got a launch out of Australia. None of them, and it's a sad story, but none of them raised sufficient funds. Several of them went a long, long way to do that, particularly Kistler.
Yes, they even dug up a bit of dirt, didn't they?
They actually did. Well, several actually, and I was also advising Asia Pacific Space Center at one stage, and they dug up dirt as well. But at the end, none of them could finally get the ultimate funding that they needed to make the projects go, and ultimately did not function, did not become reality. As a result, the space office, the space policy unit, whittled down, and SLASO, the Space Licensing and Safety Office, whittled down as well. Pretty much the only group that has ever really used the Space Licensing and Safety Office have been the Optus. Every time they launch a satellite, they need to get a permit from the office to do that. And also the scramjet research guys, originally through the University of Queensland, and now a broader consortium doing that, they have done some test flights out of Woomera, and they've needed safety regulations for those flights. So the office didn't really have a whole lot to do. The government found it very difficult to keep staff to do that. And so it actually winnowed down to not even half the time of a single person, who was responsible for all sorts of other things at that stage. So it was a sad demise, because they had some really good people there, but they all got shifted to other things within government. So that's been the state of play. And during that phase, they came out with the fact that, look, Australia really feels that space should be a commercial concern. They're very happy for things to be done in space in Australia, but the government is not going to be involved in any way, other than licensing if that's what's required. But beyond that, it's a purely commercial venture. People have to go their own way. And so essentially they came up with a statement which was sort of saying, Australia's policy is not to have a policy. So your original assertion was somewhat correct. A number of us, however, decided that that was really a bit of a head in the sand type of approach, particularly with the significant developments in space happening worldwide throughout the 2000s, the decade of the 2000s. In particular, the movement towards space flight, commercial space flight in a number of venues, the first one being the XPRIZE process, mm-hmm. when Burt Rutan's team actually made it to space and back, and again and back within 2 weeks. And that kicked off a lot. Well, it didn't kick it off. It culminated the efforts of about seven different groups who were seriously trying to win that XPRIZE, many of whom are still involved in trying for the big holy grail, actually getting tourist flights to space. Now, clearly, Virgin Galactic has stepped in to try and do something about that, with Richard Branson and his funding behind it. They have engaged Burt Rutan to design their vehicles for space tourism. But there is still a lot of other groups behind the scenes that are working on that.
People like X-Corps, for example.
Exactly. And don't be surprised if some of those actually come to fruition. But that happened in 2004, and the Australian government had no real knowledge that that was happening. Another major development during this time, which is probably of far more useful import to Australia, is the fact that satellites, the technology to make satellites, was becoming cheaper and becoming more compact. And so it was now possible to develop a lot of satellites for very low cost that could do tremendous science and communications. And the leader in this was Surrey Satellite out of the UK, who developed a very small satellite bus, low power. They were putting the things up, and there became this movement to what you would call fast response space, where you would look at, in some cases, it was very useful. For example, suppose you had a flood. There's a lot of Earth observation satellites up there, and they can do a very, very good job, but you might want to just pop up your own satellite to take very specific images of very specific areas. And if the cost is cheap enough, and the cost to launch is cheap enough, that is a very viable way to go. There's certainly military applications for that, in, you know, tactical maneuvers for the military. So there's a wide range of groups that were very interested in this. The U.S. Air Force was particularly looking at this. And as the cost of satellites and the punch, the power that these satellites had, and the ability to do some very good science, even if it was only for 6 months or 1 year, in many cases, it made more sense to put up something that was going to last for a year than to put up a 15-year satellite that didn't do what you needed in that specific, that had to be flexible enough to do all sorts of things over 15 years, and hence got into the range of $200 million plus another $100 million for launch to make that happen. If you could get something for $50 million that did what you needed for the next year, that became a very interesting trade-off. And so around the world in the space community, these were two major drivers that were happening in the mid-2000s. Now, it turned out the Australian government was just not monitoring this at all. That because they had closed the space office, because they had dropped their staff levels down to a very skeleton staff of half a person, it really could not stay abreast of a lot of these things. So within the Chamber of Commerce and now the Industry Association, we have been pushing and lobbying, trying to make politicians aware of the possibilities in these spheres. And it became very clear to us that there was a wide range of issues in space that covered a lot of departments within government, not just industry, which had always been sort of seen as a means to further the space components such as they are in Australia. There was transport aspects. The GPS service was now becoming almost standard in all sorts of applications, particularly long-distance trucking, particularly land surveys and land mapping, and, for example, monitoring the where a flood had been and where it ended up, where the riverbank ended up once the flood had receded, the movement of land, those types of things. Tremendous applications emerging worldwide in navigation and timing, because the GPS satellites provide timing for a lot of the various networks around Australia, including most of the ATM networks. There was a lot of Earth observation data needed. I mean, obviously better weather data, but also for land mapping applications. And there was a merging of that GPS coordinate onto the actual terrain maps that you would get from a satellite. So there was a lot of happening in this field, plus advancements in telecommunications as well, such as moving to the Ka-band spectrum and the multifold communications, and the throughput, the data throughput capacity could be increased many times on a commercial satellite, which is now what we have being built as part of the NBN network. So there was a wide range of things happening across all the major spheres of space data application: communications, Earth observation, and navigation and timing, that really warranted a broader look by the Australian government. What do we need to do to be part of this game? Simply to meet our national needs. And of course, overlaid on top of that, you had the emerging security realm. It's a different world than it was 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. And we now, what do we need to do to secure our nation in these more difficult times? So all of these factors started to come together. We thought, those of us in the space community, thought it was a very compelling story right from the start. But over time, through our lobbying, we began to get people in government to actually say, why aren't we doing something more about this? Now, I was involved in a group that was formed in the mid-2000s, formed by Senator Grant Chapman from South Australia, called the Space Policy Advisory Group. The Space Industry Association, or the Chamber of Commerce, Australian Space Industry Chamber of Commerce, as it was in those days, went to Senator Chapman, who is a long time, who has had a long time interest in space. His father had worked at WMRA, and so he had always kept abreast of these things. And he realized that, yes, he was a minister, not a minister, but he was liberal, and hence involved in the Howard government at that stage. And so he went to the members of the Howard government and said, look, we really need to do something about this. We should perhaps rethink this. And so he formed a group of key experts within Australia, which was called the Space Policy Advisory Group, to help him formulate the story that of what was happening in space and where we might want to go with that as a nation. Should the government actually be involved in a greater way than it had been, simply in monitoring and ensuring that what was needed in Australia, that Australia could get access to these increasingly vital assets. Now, Australia, for many, many years, has had access to tremendous space assets through its U.S. alliance. And that has served us very, very well. We've also been involved in, because of the nature of the tracking facilities we run in Australia, certainly through the European Space Agency, we've had access to data from the Europeans. And clearly, we've had good relations with Japan, and they've had an active satellite program, and we've been able to get a lot of information, a lot of data coming from some of their satellites as they pass over Australia. Or in the case of weather, we use Japanese and Chinese weather satellites now as our primary sources. So we've developed at an operational level through the Bureau of Met, through Geosciences Australia and a number of other government organizations, and operational links into these things. And in some ways, but by and large, we're not paying for that data. And as this data gets, as it gets more expensive to keep the satellites in the sky, to keep the things operational, a lot of these organizations are starting to get increasingly concerned about the fact that we're not prepared to exactly pay for these things. Now, we do provide ground downlinks for some of these satellites, which is a benefit to these people. So you could argue that we're providing something in some way. That's been sufficient in the past, but we always needed to consider what will happen in the future. If things change slightly politically, if things change slightly from a commercial perspective or from an operational perspective, what does Australia need to do to ensure that it gets continued access to these valuable resources that the nation critically relies on these days? So this was the genesis of what we in the industry association went to government with and said, we think you need to look at something like this. The Space Policy Advisory Group under Senator Chapman produced a report which went to the government, to the Howard government. They were considering that. They decided that there was some merit in what was happening, but they were probably in a mode of looking at what action they probably needed to take when the election came. With the election, the Rudd government came in, and Kevin Rudd, whatever else people might think of him, he was actively involved in the space industry. He knew the importance of space. And in that context, he was very interested in making something happen along those lines. At the same time, Senator Chapman decided that he was leaving the Senate at that point, shortly after the Rudd government. So in June of 2008, it was his departure from the Senate. He wanted to put something on the record, and so he lobbied to get a Senate inquiry into Australia's use of space. And he was joined by the Greens in that, and then by Labor. And they had a multi-party Senate inquiry, which is unusual. I should say most Senate inquiries always involve multiple parties. However, it was unusual in that all three parties supported having an inquiry. And the outcome of that inquiry is available. You might refer your users or your listeners to it on the link, but it's available on the government's space website, space.com.au. it basically said Australia did need to take a more active role in managing its own access to space assets. So with that in mind, the Rudd government, in their first budget, actually carved out the first money for space use in Australia, specifically dedicated for use in space, in 15 years. Oh, sorry, since 96, basically. So whatever that was, in 2008 they came out with this. 2009 they came out with this. So it was, what do you call, 12 years. First dedicated money for space. Now, having said that, the government itself, through defense, through transport, through the department that the Bureau of Met comes under, which escapes me at the moment, but they're spending money on space in various different ways. It just had not been clear to anybody. At an operational level, this was happening. CSIRO, to some degree, is also doing that. But at a nobody had a clear picture of everything Australia was doing, so, and how important it was.
Everyone was doing their own thing without considering
their
interaction with others.
In their operational budget without considering what others were doing. And hence, there might have been advantages that we could have. We might have had enough data needs on particular satellites to afford our own satellite. So there was a wide range of stuff that needed to happen. And that was one of the things the Senate inquiry, one of the recommendations of the Senate inquiry, coordinate among the various government, federal government departments, what is going on in space. So from that time, there's been a number of activities going on. And one of which was the Rudd government formed, or reformed, we should say, probably a better terminology is beefed up, the space policy unit. So they went from half a person some of the time to a dedicated staff of about seven, eight, there might even be up to nine people now, running space policy. And one of their goals was to provide, was to develop a space policy for Australia. So that process has been going on for the last 2 years. And I've been involved in that process a little bit behind the scenes as through the Space Industry Association of Australia. Also, Asia Pacific Aerospace Consultants was contracted by the government to actually do a survey of all of the, how important is Australia, space to Australia. We were asked to provide, to survey the number of organizations active in space in Australia. Now, non-federal government, by the way, because the federal government was going to do their own little research within the federal sphere. They asked us to look at anything else. So industry, nonprofits, state government, anything that was not the federal government. And to identify how the number of organizations, how many people were involved, and in general, the, you know, what's the benefit to Australia in economic terms. Now, Andrew, I know we chatted about this the other day, but for your viewers or your listeners, what do you think, off the top of your head, might be the number of organizations involved in some way in space in Australia?
And I'd have said about 10 to 20.
10 to 20. Our survey, and again, we looked as deeply as we could. We wanted to make sure that we covered anybody who had was earning some income or had a role in space. We found 631 organizations across Australia. 10 to 20 might be the real big ones, but 631. And this includes state departments in almost all the states, largely involved in land mapping, use of space, so Earth observation, purchasing Earth observation data, using or developing GPS systems for their surveyors. We also found, for example, the antenna installers, you know, for the direct-to-home TV dishes. There's a lot of electronics firms that are doing that. They're getting a tidy little income out of something derived from space. There's also the major satellite operators. What we interestingly found was that there were 14 satellite operators providing services into Australia. That is a very, very high ratio. What was also interesting is that a number of those actually had their either a major office here, or in some cases, even their head office for the Asia-Pacific region was here. So there are a lot of people involved in space, a lot more than the government had realized. And that was a real eye-opener to the government. We actually estimated, we had solid results, and we estimated the rest because we didn't get responses from everybody. But there's somewhere around 10,000 people involved in space in Australia, and maybe even as high as 18,000. There, the money, in monetary terms, space, the utilization of space brings in as a minimum $1 billion of economic activity in Australia, as a minimum each year. It could be as high as $2.2 billion. So it's somewhere in that $1 billion to $2.2 billion range. It's a little bit difficult to pin that down exactly, but we know it's at least $1 billion per year, which is no small change by anybody's counting.
So you were able to counter the public perception that space is moon trips and space shuttles?
Counter the government's perception about that. One of the real concerns successive Australian governments have had is that space is a bit of a white elephant. They've seen the massive amounts of dollars that NASA gets, and they just know that Australia as a country cannot afford that. While, you know, I think they're also a little bit out of touch with many of your viewers and just how strong the interest is for space, and the fact that, you know, Andy Thomas is an Australian who had to go and live in the United States to pursue his dream is an interesting fact. However, the government does need to measure what it can do with the resources it has. So they've always been afraid of the big dollars required for space. What we've been trying to do is reshape the picture to A, show that there are very valuable and essential assets and data that we get from space that we must maintain, and also that it does not, that the cost of getting to space has dropped. You can, within the realm of things that Australia could afford. So yes, we probably still would not be probably going down the path of a full service 15-year life satellite. We may, for example, Australia bought into the wideband global SATCOM system, which is a military-based system from the U.S. Now, that was the best way to meet defense's military communication needs worldwide. So there are six satellites in the system. Australia paid for the sixth satellite as a way to buy into the system, but it gives Australia a fixed amount of satellite military capacity worldwide, whatever theater of operation Australia needs to operate in. And that's a very, very useful thing. So the government was prepared in different times to say, hey, this is a real need, we can do that. And it made much more sense to do that than to buy into a single satellite, which would only be fixed beams over the region that you picked, be it Australia and the regions north, etc. So the government does recognize this. And this is part of what it's been trying to come to terms with over the last 2 years, to come up with a space policy that enunciates Australia's needs in space, why we need to be active in space, and then which way we are going to move with that. So that is certainly, like I said, I've been involved in that the last few years. Our studies, by the way, you can read the executive summary of the APAC study on the space.com.au website. There are also two other studies the government commissioned at that stage. One was for Australia's space capability, and the other one was for the international space scene. All of those three studies, the exact summaries of those studies, are available on the space.com.au website. Now, when you recently, I guess, were coming to fruition, initially the policy was supposed to be out within 1 year. The government, the Space Policy Unit, recognized it was going to be a tough ask to get it done in 1 year, and so it's expanded to two. Part of that has been socializing it within government, within the various government departments, with the various ministers, and actually educating them to the importance of space to their particular portfolio. And by and large, now, they have completed that process and have got agreement from all of those different departments that on the framework of the policy. Several of us were who've been heavily involved were invited to Parliament in the middle of October last month to get a preview of the policy. Now, I can't talk about that publicly here, unfortunately, because it's not officially released. But I do know that the government's focus, it's a reasonably good policy, and it is those of us who were invited to comment needed to make our submissions by the end of last week. And so the Space Industry Association of Australia has put in a submission. I'm sure many others have as well. That will be assimilated by the government and then will be formatted into the final policy, which will get approved. It may be released as early as the end of this month, November 2012, possibly in December, possibly in January or February in 2013. So somewhere within the next few months, we will finally have another Australian space policy.
Quite a story.
Now, I could tell you just briefly a few of the major thrusts of the policy, perhaps. One is Australia recognizes that one of the biggest advantages of getting things from space is the data that's returned. The British actually formed their own space office. They had had one and then got rid of it. They never really had one. They have formed their own space office within the last 2 years. As part of their research towards that, they came up with a concept of the upstream-downstream model. So upstream are the things that go into space. And of course, they're highly technical, the satellites, the rockets that get them up there and maintain them in space. Then you have this in-between mode, which are the Earth stations that communicate with those satellites to keep them in their proper orbit. Then you have the downstream section, which is all of the data streams that come from that satellite. And if you look at the economics of that, the margins for economic margins for putting things into space, their expensive assets, have to be extremely well engineered and fine-tuned. Very expensive. They can be expensive, although, as I've talked about, you can get the small sats, which now can be at a cheaper cost, but of course they can't do everything that the big satellites do. The margins on those for launch and for satellites are much smaller than you think, possibly in the 4-5% range. It's not a lot of profit, and it's a lot of risk attached to that type of thing. You then, when you look at the downstream section, the operators, that's where the money is because they have a much bigger market. And so ultimately the government is probably going to come out in its policy saying that it is that downstream segment that we feel Australia should focus on mostly. And so we know there will be three key areas, and that is the three key areas of space: communications, timing and navigation, and Earth observation. So those are the three key areas that will be part of this, and primarily the downstream component. So like I say, within the next, I would say at the outside, within 3 months, we will have another space policy. And I'm sure your listeners will all be very interested in getting a copy of that and having a look. And then the inevitable debates will start again. But from where we've come to where we're at now, personally, I think it's a tremendous step because it's the first time that government has been well educated about the need for Australia to be involved in space. And so from that perspective, I think it's actually a dawning of a new age in Australian space coming within the next couple of months.
And would putting into effect that policy be put at risk by a change of government?
That's a very good question. I know that the coalition recognizes that that's a very space is an important component, and therefore they are looking at developing their own policy around that. I personally think, from what I've seen of the policy, that it is going to be something that will be endorsed by both. I can't speak, of course, for the coalition, but and, of course, inevitably governments like to tinker with a few things themselves. But I would think that the momentum is there, not only at the ministerial level, which, of course, could change, but at the House member level and at the Senate member level. There's a much more basic understanding of the importance of space, but in particular at the departmental level. And those are the civil servants who don't change. They all now recognize, and they are all very supportive of having a policy to help them, help guide them in terms of the way they do their business, and because they are more and more increasingly using space assets or information coming from space assets to do their work. So given the education process that we've gone through at those levels in the last while, we believe that, or I personally believe, that the coalition will have some sort of space policy, which probably will not be too dissimilar to the to whatever the is announced by the current Labour government. Now, whether there will be funding and how much funding there will be is the $64 million question. So it could well be that we see a policy with no funding attached to it, but at least it provides a framework upon which other things can be built. As everyone knows, the government's trying to balance the budget at the moment, so their money is hard to come by. But as need arises, there will be a policy framework in place that money can be attached to. And it's much easier to get money when you've got a framework in place that everybody can look at and say, hey, yes, we need to do this. Everybody agreed on this as part of the policy. And to do that, we need this. It's a lot easier to get money that way than just, oh, look, we'd like to have some money for a space project. That's very hard to find that discretionary funding for. So the policy is the first, that framework policy is a critical first step upon which everything else can be built. And we, within the Space Industry Association of Australia, think it's a tremendous step to finally have something like that after these 12 long years in the wilderness.
I should say. Now, one last thing. Have you considered to make craft the policy so it's not an all or nothing, that it can be done incrementally in parts?
That's why I call it a framework policy. It will set out some of the essential things that Australia, why Australia would want to be involved in aspects of space. And so those are core things, security of the nation, that type of stuff. And what that means at an operational level, that's where the devil's in the details. So yes, the framework policy, which will come out and be announced, will be that broad stroke type thing saying these are the essentials. This is what everything should be aligned with, meeting these essential things for our nation. Beyond that, the individual projects will have to argue their own case. So,
well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Bill.
Well, thank you for having me, Andrew. It's been, you've reminded me that I've actually been on this program before many, many years ago. So I'm very pleased to have met with you up here in Port Douglas and to have the opportunity to actually tell you something, and you and your listeners, something about what's been going on in the Australian space policy arena for the last several years.
Thanks again.